Mr. Murray Lee, real fine.
Seeing that the tradesmen didn't know what was going on inside one of the training schools and things of that sort, and that unauthorised people couldn't get in. That's the physical side of security. And then you have the, what I call the more esoteric side, which is the, you get into the double cross system, running double agents, the very high grade interrogation of people coming out of occupied territories, where the information can be a mixture of politics, military, economic, and where the interrogation has to be carried out in tremendous detail, and also because the information which comes out in tremendous secrecy. That is what I would imagine people like Hugh Park and Dickie Warden and John Center were up to. They weren't concerned with the physical side of security, which was my job. My job also, although it was physical security, also included, as I've described earlier, the NCOs who were going around with the agents to see what sort of chaps they were and what their characters were like. I don't think I've said very much about the liaison with the country sections.
Could you do that now?
Yeah. SOE was divided, like all these organisations, into country sections. We French, Belgian, Norwegian. I don't think we had a Swedish one. Danish, German, Italian, Spanish, Portuguese. Yugoslav. All the Balkans and Yugoslavia is run from Cairo. So we were really, yes, Italy and Austria we did too. We couldn't do very much in Germany and Austria, although we did recruit a considerable number of German Jews who joined we put them into the Royal West Kent Regiment, very brave chaps, and they went over as SOE people in uniform. On commando raids, like the one on Dieppe and the one where they got that, we destroyed a radar station somewhere near Dieppe, I can't remember what it was called now. Bruneval, that's right. And we, a couple of our German Jews went over, and their job was to shout confusing orders in German to upset the German defences. It worked pretty well. One of them got caught. And before he went over, I'd worked out a cover story for him with phony relatives and all that sort of thing. And I was his uncle in this cover story. I forget what my name was. And the idea was that if he got caught, the other one was killed, if he got caught, he would write to me through the Red Cross. And once we got the letter back through the Red Cross, he'd been given a code. The reply was, which I had to write in my own writing, was concocted by the cryptographers to include sabotage messages or sabotage instructions for him, which took a long time to get there because it had to go through Geneva. I had to go down to St. James's Palace to suck up to the Red Cross and tell them what we were up to, and the woman there was a bit sort of hoity-toity, and she thought it wasn't quite nice. But eventually I prevailed upon her to think of England and her duty, and she had allowed this correspondence to go through. It was very successful because this chap didn't look very Jewish, luckily for him, and because he spoke German, which he allowed his captors to find out gradually that he spoke a little German, he was allowed out on working parties in armaments factories, because they used any form of labour they could lay their hands on. It was strictly against the Geneva Convention, but he volunteered for this work. And because we were able to send him sabotage instructions how to wreck machinery in the factories that he was working. That was great fun. But then when I eventually had to go to North Africa, I had to die of double pneumonia. And so my correspondence with him was taken over by one of my corporals who'd been promoted to a captain by that time, and I don't know what happened afterwards. It was great fun. Where were we? Physical security in the more esoteric side, yes.
Well, you were talking about liaison with the country sections.
And the country sections, yes. I found Maurice Buckmaster, who ran the French section, was absolutely wonderful. His attitude towards security was first class, and we got on like a house on fire, and I never had any difficulty at all. The Belgians were not so good. It was first run by a very nice guardsman, guardie officer, Claude Knight. And then that was taken over by, he was moved on to something else, and Hardy Amis came in. Dear old, tremendous character, because, well, as you know, he was a dress designer, and he wasn't a bit keen on the ordinary type of uniform that tailors produce for he designed his own uniform, which was very smart. But he also came to us with quite a reputation. He'd been, I think, an ordinary infantry officer, and before he came to run the Dutch section, Belgian section, he'd been down in our finishing training schools at in Bewley in the New Forest. Somebody told me that one day he used to lecture on hand grenades and things like that, so he always used to lecture to these students with drawings of these wretched instruments of destruction. He never had the real thing, though, or anything like that. And after the Battle of El Alamein, quite a number of wounded officers who'd been too badly wounded to be sent back to duty were drafted to schools like our training schools in Bewley and Arisaig, where they took over the lecturing on these on explosives. And Auntie Hardy had one of these chaps seconded to him, and so he stood by during the first lecture. And when he went in before the lecture started, this officer said, well, where are the hand grenades? And he said, right, Hardy Amis, I don't use hand grenades, I lecture from these pictures. He said, you can't do that. You've got to have the real thing. So he went out and he got hold of a whole lot of hand grenades, then started lecturing, and he pulled the pin out of one of these bloody things in front of all these poles or he was lecturing to, and the damn thing started to tick. Something had gone wrong with it, and he flung it out of the window. Everybody, straight under the desks, you see, a tremendous explosion out of the window. The next thing that anybody heard was tap, 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 tap with the wand that he used to use. This was Auntie Hardy, the only man who hadn't taken cover, banging on the desk. Said, there you are, I told you not to use those nasty, horrible, dangerous things. He was a wonderful man. But I never thought his security was very good, because I remember one of my Belgian NCOs came back off a course and reported on a very tough ex-garage mechanic who was a very good wireless operator. But he said to me that this chap is absolutely appalling. He gets drunk as a coot at the slightest opportunity. And if you give him a fiver, he blows the lot. If you give him £10, he blows it. If you give him £25, he blows it. And he picks up the most awful women, which he noticed, you see, when they were having leave on the courses. And so I said, this man must not be allowed to go on operations. He'd be a danger to the people he was... because I used to have to report to the heads of the country sections on the reports of my NCOs and say yes or no whether, from a security point of view, this should have a good risk. And it wasn't my job. If I was overruled, so be it. Well, the Belgians overruled this, sent this chap in, a whole lot of francs around in a money belt around his best, dropped in somewhere near Brussels. First thing he does, picks up a peroxide blonde, takes her into the Palace Hotel, which is the biggest hotel in Brussels, where absolutely stiff with Gestapo people, sits down with dirty fingernails and a peroxide blonde, helps himself to a big dinner, and wonder why he gets arrested. 18 people were shot as a result of that. It's not very good news, really. So we were a bit sort of sad about that. I also had quite a lot of trouble with some of the commandants of the training schools who used to think that we were sort of Gestapo people. But eventually, by spending a lot of time talking to them and explaining what we were trying to do, they began to sort of reluctantly agree that there was something in what our activities were concerned with. I had quite a lot to do with Hollingworth, who ran the Danes. He was a marvellous man, Commander Hollingworth. I think he's been given the freedom of Copenhagen. He's very, very popular in Denmark. The Dutch were rather a law unto themselves. They were very tied in with the Dutch government in exile. And as has been sadly written, they were terribly badly penetrated very early on, and practically every agent that was dropped into Holland got caught by the Abwehr and subsequently executed by the Gestapo. Bastards. They really were very unpleasant people, the Gestapo. There were some nice ones. I met a very nice one in Capri after the war.
Why was he nice?
Why, he was an aristocrat and he was involved, and he was doing the sort of decent type of work that I was doing. Even the Gestapo had branches where perfectly ordinary intelligence duties were carried out. They weren't all thugs, but people like Barbie in Lyon, the ones who were operating against the resistance, were absolute skunks. Terrible people. Hugo Bleicher, the one who interrogated Odette Sanson, who was married Peter Churchill after the war. He was quite a nice little man. And Gieskes, the Abwehr man in Holland, an extremely nice chap, but he was Abwehr.
You were talking about the different sections, and you had just mentioned the Danish and Dutch sections.
Yes, Norwegians, wonderful people. I'm trying to remember the name of the man who ran the Norwegian section. I think his name was Wilson, very nice man. But of course, the Norwegian section were best known for the Shetland bus, which ran from, there were Norwegian fishing boats which ran from Lerwick over to Norway in summer and winter. And it was really run by a splendid man called Martin Linge, L-I-N-G-E, who is really a Norwegian resistance hero. And Andy Lassen, who was on the Shetland bus. That was an absolutely incredible operation. I think that's been written up. The Norwegians ran from, were trained in Aviemore. They had a wonderful commando training school there. And I think I'm right in saying that King Olaf was part of the staff there during the war. Because his father, Håkon, came out as Norwegian government in exile. I think Olaf is about 77, 78, yes. So he'd have been, I think he was involved with Aviemore. And of course that, we had all sorts of curious things. I remember earlier on in this talk, I was talking about 12 Roland Gardens, which is run by two very strange chaps who were friends. One was called Dennis Rake and the other one was called Fox. And Dennis Rake said I was perfectly all right because I wasn't any danger to him because I wasn't likely to take any of his boyfriends because I wasn't one like him. And this was a very strange house. And Michael Redgrave was in there when he was just beginning to get going on the theatre. And when I got kicked out of France in summer 1939, I made a beeline for Sadler's Wells, and I was standing in the queue there waiting for a ticket, and in front of me I suddenly heard this strange voice asking for a ticket. And I looked at this little man, dressed up as a company sergeant major. I said, "My God, Dennis, what on earth are you doing here?" He said, "Buddy, I've just come back from Bordeaux. This was the end of July, 1940. Anyway, I didn't see him again until I was looking at the new intake of French section agents in the middle of 1942, because I used to have their real names. In fact, I was the only person in SOE who knew this. I had their real names, their training, their French section number, and their training alias. And obviously, Maurice Buck, the country section people knew their real names and so on, but in the rest of SOE, I was the only person who knew this. My NCOs didn't. All they knew was the training alias. And his name was, training alias, I remember, was Dieudonné. Dieudonné, God-given. And I suddenly saw, Second Lieutenant Rake, 27F15, or whatever the number was, and then Dieudonné. I couldn't believe it. Well, I had a very good NCO called Donaldson, who was one of my Frenchmen, who went round on this course. And before they went round, I used to interview my NCOs and brief them, ask them if they were happy and, you know, any particular things that I wanted them to look out for, any operational information that had come in which would help them. And at the end of this interview, Donaldson said to me, any agents you're particularly interested in, sir? So I said, no, I don't think so. There's a chap here, rather funny name, Dennis Rake. I was having a name like that. I didn't let on, he said, I knew him. I said, you might just tell me what happens on the course. Quite interested. I mean, something for you to do. There's nothing else of particular interest on this. 13 weeks later, he came back. And in the meantime, I used to get these weekly reports, and all these reports showed that he was a very good radio operator. Not very interested in bangs or silent killing or anything like that, or any of the nasty side of life. So when he came back, I had Donaldson in, because I always used to go through all the reports with them before I sent it to the country section head to make quite sure that my NCO and I really understood the form, and we made secondary notes, and because we had to be very careful what we said. We couldn't upset operations by just being stupid. And at the same time, we had to warn the country section's head if we'd found anything that was liable to jeopardize their operations once they went into the field. After all, it's very important for people to stay alive in a setup like this. And at the end of this, I didn't say anything about Rake. Donaldson said, oh, sir, you asked me to pay attention to Second Lieutenant Rake. So I said, oh, yes, sir, I remember that. So why? He said, did you know him, sir? So I said, I don't think so, no, it's just a funny name. I said, what do you think about him? He said, well, to put it mildly, sir, he's not quite like us, is he? So I said, what do you mean? He said, well, I've got a feeling he prefers men to women. So I said, oh, really? How interesting. What happened? He said, well, it's very strange. We went to Wanborough to begin with, and he absolutely flatly refused to use any form of weapon. He wouldn't fire a gun or any explosives or anything of that sort. He said, no, I just want to work my radio set. And he was a marvellous radio operator, absolutely marvellous. Then we went up to Arisaig. Arisaig was the commando area, and there were dozens of houses there. Well, we had to keep all these nationalities separate, you see. I knew Arisaig had Poles in it, and Kamisterik had Belgians, and I've forgotten the name of the other houses, about six or seven other ones, and they were all kept apart, always. We went up there. He was always last on all the commando courses. He loathed it. Then we went down to Ringway to do the parachute jumps. It was near Manchester, you see, where they used to have to do 3 daylight, they had their practice ones from balloons, and then 3 daylight jumps and 2 night jumps. Just in case they had to be dropped in, you see. And Dennis Rake went through all this, sir, he said. And then we came to the 3 daylight drops, and when the green light went on for Dennis to go through the hole, He turned round to the dispatch sergeant and said, "My dear, you have to throw me out. I couldn't possibly jump." "And you won't," he said, "so you won't believe it." He was thrown out three times in the day and thrice at night. And eventually, I couldn't resist. I had to go over and see Maurice Buckmaster about this, and I told him that I knew this chap. And he said, well, Peter, I know we've heard all about this, and he really is such a remarkable operator. We're going to send him in by submarine. We couldn't possibly send him in on the end of a parachute." And he did. He went in by submarine to Cap d'Antibes, which was the favourite dropping point. It was actually at Le Théoul, just west of Antibes, just west of Cannes, rather, at an hotel called the Saint-Christophe, which I stayed in afterwards. It's got a marvellous hidden little bathing rock bathing pool, which is surrounded by rocks, and there's a fairly narrow inlet, and you can get a canoe in, and then it opens out into this little lagoon, and you can sort of sink your canoe into the lagoon and then walk up the steps and into the grounds of the Saint-Christophe and out on the main road and catch a bus to Cannes. It was very convenient for agents going in. And eventually Peter Churchill received him and he was sent up to Lyon. He went across the demarcation and got caught in Paris. He used to tell me the most extraordinary stories, which I'm told are quite untrue, about having his teeth filed down level with the gums and both his ankles broken over a wooden sawhorse with an iron bar, bang, like that, but the Gestapo. And having his strung upside down and whipped with steel rods and his skull fractured in two places and all that sort of stuff. But somebody told me it's absolutely quite untrue. I met Nancy Wake, who he worked with, and he said, oh, she told the most extraordinary stories. Nobody believed a word of it. And I asked him after the war, why he did this, why he joined up. He said, "Man, you see, my dad, the Germans shot my father for working with Nurse Cavell in the First World War, and I wanted to get my own back on them." Amazing. He eventually, well, after he was captured, he walked out over the Pyrenees and did 6 months in Miranda, came back to England, and then he was dropped back in again to Nancy Wake in the Dordogne. Nancy Wake was an extraordinary Australian woman. She comes over to England about twice a year and creates tremendous havoc in the club. Great fun. Tough as hell. The other country sections are all extremely helpful. There was Caesar, whose real name I've forgotten, who was doing Hungary from Baker Street, although the agents were dropped in from Cairo. I think it was Felix somebody, but his name is, we always knew him as Caesar. Then there was the Germans, who run very nice Cheryl Thornton, who was running the Germans, and Jacqueline Fort, of course, was in, and Henry Thelfall, whom I got to know. Another very nice chap who died of gangrene in Yugoslavia, colonel in the Coldstream Guards. I got his name somewhere, I forget the one. Terribly nice man. Nothing much doing in Italy. At that time, Italy didn't really get going until we went to North Africa. We weren't sending any agents into Spain that I can remember. Our liaison with Spain was really through SIS. We had a station in Lisbon. In fact, Jacqueline Fort went out to Lisbon after Stockholm. Gibraltar was our main operating base in the Mediterranean, Western Mediterranean, until we went into North Africa. All operations into South France went from Gibraltar. They were, the country section people were marvellous. We all sort of were doing 7 days, almost day and night. We literally did nothing else but work. It was a pain to go on leave, because if we had a week's leave, we came back to a mountain of work. and trying to catch up with what had been going on while you were away wasn't worthwhile going on leave, but the end result was that one got so stale that after a time you really had to take 3 days off in order to straighten your brain out so that you could. I remember people used to come into my office and ask me a question, I couldn't answer it. I couldn't think of the answer. It was simply staleness. And this was going back to Matlock, who told us on no circumstances, when you're really heavily work, you must take 3 hours off every day. And of course we didn't do it, because we couldn't. In practice, that's what happens. And numbers of times I used to leave Baker Street at 12 and 1 in the morning and then be back there at 9 o'clock the next morning, Saturdays and Sundays included.
You also said that your social life was restricted to,
yes,
to the people.
Yes, my diaries, unhappily. And we couldn't keep any operational diaries, obviously. But the notes that I did keep are a very long story of drink and debauchery in the few hours that we could have off. Because if you remember, when I first started talking about SOE, the only thing I knew about them, one of the only things I knew about them, was they had alleged to have the most beautiful secretaries in the whole of the British Army. And it was absolutely dead true. In our security section, we had two absolute knockouts. There was Margarita, whom I've already mentioned, and an extremely nice girl called Joy de Cossen, as she was. No, Joy Lloyd. Joy Lloyd. She married a chap I was at Trinity with called Tony de Cossen. And they were absolutely charming, and Audrey something, who was John Center's secretary. And I spent a great deal of time with them. And we used to go to the 400 when we could get a night off. And I think nothing of knocking off a bottle of brandy between the two of us, come home about 4 in the morning.
I think we ought to explain that the 400 is a club in Leicester Square.
400, to those of us who were brought up in the 30s, everybody will know who it is, but 400 was a nightclub in Leicester Square, next door, not the Empire, next door to the Leicester Square cinemas on the south side. There's another one on the Odeon Leicester Square, I think it is, the Odeon Leicester Square. It was just to the right of that as you look at the front of the cinema. It used to smell like nothing on earth in daylight hours, but at night time it was a club which you paid a pound to become a member. And of course the drink laws in England are so idiotic that you're allowed to, provided you have a sandwich, you can drink all night in those clubs in those days. I don't know where you can do that now. And we used to go in there and always had a very good band and a cabaret. Started about 12, so we could work till 11 and then go to the 400 and start getting blotto. And we'd think nothing of knocking off a bottle of brandy or whiskey or gin and a sitting, two of us. But then, you see, bottle of brandy would have been about 45p, bottle of whiskey would have been 40p, bottle of gin, 40p. And as you were paid in crisp £5 notes, it was not a very expensive evening.
Well, no, I think you were saying that your friends had to be more or less restricted to your colleagues.
Well, that's true, because and our work at that time was extremely secret. People in the War Office knew that there was an organisation called SOE, but they didn't know where it was. They thought it was something to do with sabotage, but they didn't know who was in it. That's why we had these War Office cover stories, MO1SP and all that sort of stuff. And it was such a strain talking to anybody who was not involved in the racket, as we called it, because we were at least 3 weeks ahead of the news all the time. I don't think I read a paper for about 3 years, because it was all so out of date, the stuff, and many of the operations that were recorded in the newspapers had been thought up by our what we call SIBs, Secret Intelligence Bulletins. Yes, that's right, a SIB. We used to make up these, so I didn't, but the department in Baker Street used to make up these stories about 25 E-boats had been shot up in the Channel to try and boost public morale a bit, and a few German destroyers had been sunk in the Baltic and things like that. And it's just not true, and you used to have to go and listen to people talking about this and saying how...